Let's pick up our story in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse number 11, where David has just learned that King Saul is dead, and so is Prince Jonathan. It's a couple of days after the Battle of Mount Gilboa, and an Amalekite has shown up at the compound in Ziklag, letting David know that his enemy, the king of Israel, is dead. And he claims, which I believe is a lie, as I said, that he's the one that helped Saul die. Now, he does say that Saul asked him to kill him, but he says, I did kill him, and I brought to you the crown and his personalized armband. So here's David's response. Verse 11, David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. This is a very ancient means of showing grief. Clothing had value, and so ripping your clothing showed that you cared more about the situation that you're hearing about than you did of something of great value. Verse 12, they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of He Who Is and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. So everybody is crying and weeping and wailing. They are fasting, refusing to eat because they are grief-stricken by the great loss to the nation of Israel, of all of these people, all these warriors. And I think in particular, David is very hurt by the loss of his friend Jonathan, who could have come and joined him earlier. But as I said back at that story, I think Jonathan felt the need to stand by his father in the hopes of perhaps helping him be redeemed. But that is what put Jonathan in the middle of the battle and resulted in his death on the day of the Battle of Mount Gilboa. Verse number 13. It's now evening, and David returns back to the messenger because there's some unfinished business here. Verse 13, David said to the young man who told him, where do you come from? And he answered, I am the son of a sojourner and Amalekite. So I am the son of an Amalekite family living here inside Israel. David said to him, how is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy He Who Is His anointed? Now you remember, two separate times, David had opportunity to slit Saul's throat. And yet he chose not to do it because, as he expressed on the last of those two, it is up to God to take out the one that he had anointed into the kingdom of Israel. And David suggested maybe he'll die in battle. Maybe he'll just die of some sort of physical condition. But I'm not going to raise my hand against He Who Is His anointed. And neither are any of my men. So David absolutely refused to let anyone kill Saul. That was God's job. So he is very upset and angry that this Amalekite, and remember, it's not been too many days since the Amalekites came in and raided Ziklag and took away the family members of the men who had been off to war. And David killed all that bunch of Amalekites because the Amalekites are just long-term enemies of the Israelis. They are so hateful and so spiteful toward the Israelis that they've tried to annihilate them once and capture maybe some of them at other times to turn them into slaves. And eventually God said, enough is enough, I want them gone. And Saul had been sent to get rid of them and hadn't. And here is an Amalekite, maybe a half Amalekite, half Israeli, that is living in the land and killed King Saul. So David, verse 15, called one of the young men, so one of his warriors, but one of the younger ones, and said, go execute him. And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed he who is his anointed. So he is executed for a claim that he made that I believe is a lie. He, in my opinion, only did this because he thought it would get him special treatment by the new king of Israel, David. And that's why he brought the crown and the armband, which he'd plundered, I think, with the story that he'd been the one that ended Saul's life. But it backfired on him. And so he is now gone. And David continues with his lamentation in the way that makes the most sense for him. And that is, write a song and sing it. Verse 17, David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said that it should be taught to the people of Judah, behold, it is written in the book of Yasher. Now the book of Yasher just means the book of the upright. And so it's probably the name of a collection of materials outside Scripture, but referenced by Scripture from time to time. Verse number 19. Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. So he composes the song to think about the first royal family dying on the mountain called Gilboa, and how this is a great loss for the people of Israel. Then he poetically speaks against the Philistines, the enemy who accomplished this, and puts a curse on them that they shouldn't get this type of news and think it's good. Verse 20, tell it not in Gath. And David had been associated with Gath for the last year and a half. He was doing it covertly to stay out of Saul's way, but he doesn't want this news of the death of Saul or Jonathan or the other princes to be celebrated in any of the towns of the Philistines. So tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. And he knows that's exactly what would happen, is that they will get out in the streets and dance and sing and celebrate. Verse 21, you mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. So he puts a curse. This is a poetic curse. He doesn't actually want Gilboa to become a desolate place. He wants Gilboa to pay a penance for being the site of the death of King Saul and his men. And this reference to the shield of Saul not anointed with oil, it's the fact that when survivors of a battle came home, they cleaned up all their weapons, their armor, their shields, and then they oiled them to defend them against any type of corrosion until the next time they were needed. So Saul's shield didn't get that treatment because he died and his shield fell there on the field in the mountains of Gilboa. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. So he pictures them in his mind, as he probably had seen them on other occasions, because he'd fought with them before. That Jonathan is there shooting with his bow against the enemy, and Saul is whacking away with his sword. And he anticipated that that's exactly what happened right up until the very end of their lives. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely. In life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. So he pays tribute to the love that particularly Jonathan had for his father, the devotion that he had for him. And he pays tribute to the fact that they were both good warriors. Continuing, verse 24. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the battle, in the midst of the battle. So he urges Israelis, even though Saul ended up being a tyrant, to think about him in his better days and to pay him tribute and honor. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant you've been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. And so he pays tribute to his fallen friend, his military mentor, if you would, because Jonathan kind of took him under his wing and gave him his first suit of armor and his first weapons that used to belong to Jonathan, and went out and fought with him on more than one occasion, and spent all these last, probably, we're talking about 18 years or so, just developing this friendship that was different and yet more intense, I think, than the relationship that David had with Michal, Jonathan's little sister. Verse 27, how the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. And so that becomes the song of grief that David composes, and it is spread around and sung by other Israelis over a period of probably more than a week, perhaps as much as a month of grief, public and national grief, over the loss of the king and the princes. Chapter number 2 takes place probably after the period of grief is finished. And David knows that it is now time for him to fulfill his role as the next anointed king of Israel. So after this, David inquired of he who is, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And so he's talking to the high priest that's with him, who has the ephod, who has the uniform of the high priest with the breastplate, with the pocket where the Urim and the Thummim are located. And so he's asking yes or no questions that can be answered through the Urim and the Thummim. Should I set up my headquarters as king in one of the cities of Judah? And he who is said to him, go up, or yes. David said, to which shall I go up? And then he probably goes through a list of cities. He may have said, should I go up to Bethlehem, my hometown? After all, that's what Saul did when he became king. He made Gibeah, his hometown, the new capital of Israel. But that's not going to be the case for David. He asks whether or not he should set it up at Hebron. And the answer is yes. Now, why would Hebron be a good place for the kingdom under David to be established? It's rather far south from everywhere else in United Israel, but it has something that all Israelis would agree is significant, and that is the Cave of Machpelah, the tomb cave of the patriarchs and matriarchs. It is where Abraham and Sarah are buried. It is where Isaac and Rebekah are married. And it is where Jacob, or Israel, and Leah are buried. So it would be a very special city for the nation of Israel to have as their second capital. So he said, that is, God said to him, to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. Remember, these are the two ladies from southeast of Hebron. So they're actually coming back very close to their home territory. They are the first wives of the new king of Israel. Now, I will mention once again that David, by taking multiple wives, was already starting to play around with God's instructions. God's intention from very creation was one man together with one woman for a lifetime. When he was giving the laws to Moses, he said specifically of kings, they should not multiply to themselves wives. And the main reason kings multiplied wives to themselves is because it increased their political power through alliances. So David is already fudging around that area, and it will be a problem for him later. Now, don't get me wrong, he is a man after God's own heart, but he is a man with some issues that are going to cause trouble later, and we'll deal with that when it happens. So David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. So in the towns right around Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Now, why do they start with David just being king of the tribe of Judah first? And the reason is going to become obvious very shortly here, that a son of Saul, who survived because he wasn't at the Battle of Mount Gilboa, has been set up as the king over the United Tribes of Israel. And so many of the tribes have already gone that direction. And so David is being completely accepted by the men of his own tribe and by those who have come to him from the other tribes during the last couple of years when he was on the run from King Saul. So we see here the beginning of David's kingdom is one of division within the people of Israel. Now, the next thing that David finds out about is this. When they told David, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by he who is, because you showed this loyalty to Saul your Lord and buried him. Now may he who is show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." So David reaches out in thanks to the people of Jabesh-Gilead who rescued the decapitated body of King Saul from the walls of Bethshan, just about 10 or so miles away from their city. And they took all the bodies of Saul and the princes and brought them back to Jabesh-Gilead, cremated them, and buried their bones with honor there. And so David wants to thank them for that. And he also wants to encourage them to consider him as king, because he's already been inaugurated as the king over the tribe of Judah. Now's when we find out about the surviving son of Saul. Verse number 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army. Now, we've met this man several times before. He is the cousin of the late King Saul. He is the commander, the military top general of the United Forces of Israel. So David answered to him up the chain of command up until about 2 years ago. And he was the one that David chided the last time that David spared the life of Saul by saying, "Abner, why did you let the king come into danger by not guarding him? Someone snuck into the camp and took his personal weapon and his canteen." So that's the same guy. Abner survived the Battle of Mount Gilboa and probably came back to Gibeah, the capital city, and evacuated it across the Jordan to a safe zone there. And we are told, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. So Mahanaim is a fortified city on the east side of the Jordan River in Gilead. And it is apparently much more defensible at this point in Abner's estimation than the city of Gibeah, with the Philistines on the rampage on the west and in the Jezreel, Megiddo region, Bethshan region, and probably in some portions of the northern Jordan Valley. So he decides, I've got to get everybody of the former administration to a safe area. So Ishbosheth is not the circumcised name of this man, this prince. He was christened originally Ishbaal. Later copyists of the scripture could not bring themselves to write down the name of a pagan god. So they changed this man's name from Ishbaal to Ishbosheth, which means a man of shame. It's substituting the word shame for Baal. Now, I want you to understand that back at the time that this boy was born, it was common practice of the Israelites to use the Canaanite name Baal, or the Canaanite word Baal, which means master, as a synonym for their Hebrew term Adonai, which is what they would use to refer to God himself. And so in the time of David and Saul, Ish-Baal was a perfectly acceptable name because it actually meant a man of the Lord. And I am going to always kind of bring both names into play when we're doing this, because I want you to remember that Ish-bosheth was not his real name. So he took Ish-Baal, the son of Saul, he brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead and over the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. So the northern portion of Israel is what this man is thought to be in control of. They're thinking about Judah being kind of a breakaway tribe. And this is going to begin the civil war. Let's finish with verse number 10. Ish-Baal, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign in Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of David followed David. So we know that this guy's only going to last 2 years on his throne, and he's 40 when he comes to power. And so Jonathan would have been his older brother by a couple of years, and so that gives us a sense of how old Jonathan was when he passed away.